Hey, y'all, how's it going?
Better fix that.
Good, good. Hey, welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah. Basically, it's libertarian foreign policy stuff. Today on the show, Phil Giraldi is going to be here to talk about Russia, Syria, etc., like that. Very interesting stuff. Thursday, Greg Grandin is going to be here to talk about Henry Kissinger. And, you know, it's a history lesson in the form of a biography. And tomorrow, James Bamford is going to be here to talk about his new piece at The Intercept, which is really long. I'm only about three quarters of the way through it. I'm not quite finished yet, but maybe halfway. But it's about a covert operation in Greece, the CIA and the NSA tapping phones of all the leaders there and apparently leading to the suicide, or is that suicide, parentheses, question mark, possible murder of the poor schlub that the NSA put up to it that worked at the phone company there. And so anyway, the great James Bamford, author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory, three out of four of those being about the NSA there. And there's some NSA stuff in A Pretext for War, too. And he's also written a lot of great investigative pieces for Rolling Stone and a lot of other things. But here he is at The Intercept with a story based on his own investigation, based on some Snowden documents that he says we haven't heard of before, and some more. So, the great James Bamford. I always thought that Snowden should have invited Bamford to Hong Kong with Greenwald. Although maybe that would have been too much competition for the docs there, you know. Anyway, good to know that he good to know that they're working together there. I'm a big fan of Bamford's journalism personally. Okay, so, yeah. Hey, guess what? Guess what? You don't have to listen to this show anymore. You don't have to listen to the whole show archives of the show anymore. Now iTunes finally, again, has the Just the Interviews feed up and running. It was a problem over there at Stitcher for a while, but Stitcher got it fixed. I didn't even realize that the iTunes feed was not working. For months. The whole show archive was there. Finally, someone emailed me. You would think that out of the thousands of people, okay, low thousands, but still, that subscribed to that thing, that some more people would have bothered me about it. Hey, whatever happened to the Just the Interviews feed there, Horton? Well, finally, Robert emailed me a few weeks ago. And it took me a few weeks of going back and forth with the iTunes people once I got them to actually answer me. And then, so now it's fixed. In fact, I better join up the chat room and then ask the chat room guys. Well, I'll go ahead and ask you guys now as I'm joining up the chat room. Hey, are any of you guys subscribers or formerly were subscribers to the Just the Interviews feed from iTunes? And if so, check your phone. Is it working again? Did you just download a bunch of new interviews? That's what I need to know. Someone confirm for me that it's working for you. So, anyway, yeah. Hey, chat room guys, how's things, man? I'm signing now. ScottHorton.org/chat if you want to hang out with the boys during the show here. Talk about El Caminos or whatever you're into. ScottHorton.org/chat. Fake name and a caption you're in. Just use a plain old browser window. It's also an IRC free node chat. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. If you want to join up. So, yeah, let's see, man. Yeah, some people like just the interviews. Some people like just the me complaining parts. Some people like all of it. Some people don't like any. But, you know, now we're getting a little bit far afield. But of people who like this show, it's kind of divided. And I understand that. Listen to me interview myself every day. Isn't that interesting to some? Anyway. Okay, cool, man. So there's that. Oh, also, the Tom Woods interview posted. If you want to hear me debunking the case for war. Tom got an email from a guy who was a friend of his who said, come on, Tom, you got to admit that actually the case for war turned out to be true after all, and that the damn liberal media got it all wrong because Saddam Hussein was threatened terrorism with the weapons of the mass destructions there. And so Tom says, ah, you know, this just doesn't ever go away. So brought me back on the show to again tell the story of 2002 and 3 and how they lied us into war and what it was all about. And you can find it at tomwoods.com/499. tomwoods.com/499, I think. Isn't that how he does it? Anyway, it's episode 499 of his show. Isn't that cool? He's going to have some really special guests on for episode 500, of course. But I got to be number 499 there. And yeah, I'm happy to see, you know, I got tweets from military guys saying, yep, you got it right. So, yeah, I appreciate that because I believe that that means that I got it so right that maybe they had to do a little bit of adjusting of their previous understanding. And so, you know, that takes a lot of times for people involved in it to do. But anyway, so if you're interested in that, maybe you're young. You know, I got a, I forgot. I had told half of this story before on the show, recently. I've been getting emails from this guy for a while now. We've been talking by email for a while now. And then, but I didn't know how old he was. He's an email address is, you know, and a name to me, but I don't know the guy. And then he says to me, hey, I was 11 when 9/11 happened. I was almost 13 when they invaded Iraq. So, okay, wow, cool, man. That kind of, brings a whole new grounding to my reality of who I'm talking to here, man. I try to remember all the time how old I am now and how far into the future we're living already. And how young some of you guys are. And, you know, what I remember may not be what you remember. There are people older than me who just never even took an interest in politics until they were much older. There are people who were conservatives until they heard the Tom Woods show and just thought, oh man, I'm bankrupt here. I gotta start over with liberty now. What am I gonna do? Brand new around here. So a lot of people, you never heard this stuff. So some of you heard it a million times, but maybe some of you really need to hear it. So there you go. It's over at tomwoods.com at his podcast feed there. And it's me explaining what the Iraq War II was really all about. So cool. There's that. And then also let me mention again, coming up on October the 10th, it's Make Conversation, Not War, a summit on foreign policy being held by the Texas Millennial Institute at texasmillennialinstitute.org. They are basically young Ron Paulian libertarians, college graduates, college students. Make Conversation, Not War, a summit on foreign policy at Texas Christian University. It's free. Texas Christian University, Saturday, October the 10th in Fort Worth. Speakers will be Angela Keaton, Ted Carpenter, Jacob Hornberger, and myself. So come on out. That'll be cool. You know, if you like coming out to things. If watching me on YouTube isn't quite enough for you, you want to look on me with your own eyes, then come on out, man. It'll be Texas Millennial Institute. .org. TexasMillennialInstitute.org. Meet the beautiful and charming Angela Keaton, the very friendly and gregarious radical minarchist Jacob Hornberger, and Ted Carpenter, Cato foreign policy guy who I think is pretty damn good on most stuff. I can't say too much more about him than that because I don't really know, but there you go. You know, I saw him on Judge Napolitano's show a few times and he was great, so. All right. Hey, we'll be back in a minute with some hard news for you and Phil Giraldi on Russia and Syria. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, like I said, Phil Giraldi is coming up here to talk about the new game in the Middle East now that Russia's in Syria. What it all means. It's the last, I was reading Michael Scheuer this morning. U.S., one last chance. And Scheuer says, as our enemies would say, God is great. He sent the Russians to bail our asses out of the Middle East. You fight them and leave us the hell alone. One last chance for America to give it up and bring our empire home. And he's such a curmudgeon. He's got to, you know, favor nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki and supporting all manner of atrocities against women and children in there. That guy's completely out of control, dude. I can't run that stuff on antiwar.com. But I do like the fact that he is such a right-wing nationalist curmudgeon. No libertarian by a long shot. I guess you could call him a paleo-conservative, although I don't know, you know, how many real points of agreement they have, you know, on all the different questions. But it's just great to have such a right-wing crank be such a peacenik. You know, like he's not just content to say, hey, you know, we wish those people the best, but we need to stay out of there. Right? He has to say, let them all kill each other and bathe in rivers of blood of their dead. But we should bring our guys home. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, anyway, Mike Scheuer, everybody. One last chance at nonintervention.com. And you gotta agree with it. I absolutely agree with it. At first I heard about the Russians are going into Syria. I'm saying perfect. I don't want the U.S. I agree with Scheuer 100%. I do not want the U.S. to ally again, still back and forth, on and off, on any of these sides. But in this case, the question is, and I do not want America to ally with Russia, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria, and the Iraqi Shia against the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Because that just makes their narrative about us true. That just, in fact, it proves bin Laden's point more than Baghdadi's. It proves that, see, you can't have a caliphate until you destroy the empire first. Focus on them. And only after you get rid of the Americans can you have a caliphate. Well, how about we make that Russia's problem? Everybody hates Russia so much. Let Putin, he's so smart, he's so tough, let him handle Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and, as Scheuer points out, his own jihadist in the Northern Caucasus Mountains that he has to deal with that'll surely be provoked back to action by his intervention in Syria. It's always a good day to stop being an evil world empire. Today is an especially good one. And I cannot agree with that more. And in fact, I should say the rest of that for when Giraldi's on the show. Did you guys see Putin on 60 Minutes? That was kind of fun. You know what? Here, I'll talk about the Ukraine part. So Charlie Rose is saying, well, what do you mean coup d'etat? I ain't got any idea what you mean by trying to assert there that that was an American coup d'etat. In Ukraine, he said the government there was overthrown. He didn't exactly call it a revolution. But, so then Putin says, basically, hey, come on, are you kidding me? This is, you know, you're just sitting here going on about, I'm KGB, man. I'm the president of Russia. You think I don't know for a fact what's going on in Ukraine? I'm telling you, Charlie, I know for a fact what's going on in Ukraine. I know who paid who. I know who engineered this whole thing. And he was just being polite in not invoking his intercepted and leaked phone call of Victoria Nuland plotting the coup d'etat on the phone with Jeffrey Pyatt, the ambassador to Ukraine. And Charlie Rose is saying, you know, he kind of goes on for a minute, and then they stop the tape, they play B-roll, and then they put in audio of Charlie Rose saying, well, you know, that's bunch of crap because we talked to the government today and they assured us that that is simply not true. And then they go back to the interview. Oh, hey, way to cover both sides there, Charlie. And then what's fun is I'm not sure that he had ever even heard that before. Maybe he had. Charlie Rose is such an idiot. You never know, but anyway.
I think Yatz is the guy.
Yatz is the guy. What we want to do?
I think Yatz is the guy.
Because Klitschko is too busy being a boxer, and he doesn't really know what he's doing, so...
I think Yatz is the guy.
We're going to get Yatz in there, and he's going to be the new prime minister after we overthrow the government there.
The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister, and you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yatz. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario, and I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
I think Yatz is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think.
Cleach and who? Tawny Book? Who's that? Oh, the leader of the Social Nationalist Party? Type Tawny Book right now into your little search box and search for images of Tawny Book. And you'll see there's Tawny Book with John McCain, and you'll see there's Tawny Book doing a Hitler salute.
I think Yatz is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden. And I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
Okay, great. That's Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan's wife, plotting with Jeffrey Pyatt a coup d'etat in Ukraine. Caught red-handed. And the only thing they told you on TV news about it was, oh, she used frank language, the F word. Why does she say F the EU? Because they're not moving fast enough on the coup. That's all. Hey, Al Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got Phil Giraldi on the line. Disclaimer, he's a former CIA guy, but he's all right now, man.
I detoxed.
Yeah, there you go. He's been writing truthing us out of war instead of lying us into it for quite a few years now. Well, a decade at least. So he's got that going for him. You can read him at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. And at the American Conservative Magazine, the new one at UNZ is called The Government We Deserve. And that depends on how you define we. And then sometimes the answer is yes, of course. And then also he's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. You need to know that. All right. So, hey, let's start with this. What's the John Hay Initiative, Phil?
John Hay Initiative is a little bit elusive. If you do a Google and try to find out a lot about them, you won't find out much. It's kind of a loose affiliation of a bunch of neocons out of the Bush administration. Michael Chertoff is one of them, Elliot Abrams, Paul Wolfowitz. It's called the John Hay Initiative because they meet at the John Hay Hotel in downtown Washington, and about once a month, and that's what they do. They apparently recently produced a book which outlines the entire neocon foreign policy agenda, and I'm trying to track that book down. I don't see it on Amazon yet, but it should be a real eye-opener for what the agenda is. But the interesting thing is, these are the guys that staff the positions of the Republican candidates. These are the ones that are giving them advice on how to run a foreign policy. So that's why it's important to make this connection. They had a meeting yesterday at which Kevin McCarthy, the aspirant for the Speaker of the House position, made a speech, and he basically, amidst a whole lot of misspokes and malapropisms, outlined a straight neocon foreign policy that he would pursue.
Mm. And, I read one thing about this where, I think they said, Donald Trump and maybe, Rand Paul were the only ones who had not gone and done their little pilgrimage to, you know, face east and worship these guys. It's sort of the new project for the new American century for the next generation, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like. It's the same people to a certain extent. But it's more focused, I think, on actual Republican neocon office holders from the previous administration. So you see a lot of these characters coming up, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're basically laying out the agenda, since they essentially control foreign policy for the Republican Party in terms of, you know, what the parameters are. And these are the guys doing it. So this is a group I think we have to look at a lot harder and figure out exactly what they're up to.
This is funny, this article about this McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, coming in here. Russia's hybrid warfare became high-bred warfare.
Right.
And he spoke of the Beth path forward to safety and security, which, you know, I don't know, I screw up sometimes too, but this looks pretty bad.
Yeah, but he was reading it.
Oh, yeah.
This was not an ad-lib. He was reading a script, apparently. And he was nevertheless making all these mistakes in words and everything like that. I mean, I recommend the piece. It was written by Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, whom I normally don't find terribly funny. I didn't think he had any sense of humor at all. But this piece is quite hilarious. So your listeners, I think, would benefit from looking it up and reading it.
Yeah, you don't have to be a Milbank fan to appreciate the stupidity of these Republicans. I mean, it's really something else. And, you know, they have an incentive structure built into their whole ideology that says you got to be stupid to believe this crap. So there's really no reason for them to ever really check. And then they get out here in the real world and, didn't realize they're going to actually have to apply themselves. I thought we were just going to repeat what we heard on the radio or something, you know?
Well, the whole I was alerted to some other stuff. There was also an interview with Putin done by Charlie Rose. I don't know if you saw that.
I watched it this morning. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's comic. I mean, Putin is the great statesman, and Charlie Rose is the ignoramus. He doesn't quite get anything that Putin is saying about, you know, you don't arm terrorists, you don't do this, you don't do that, and Charlie Rose doesn't quite get it. And I think it's something in the water or something, the fluoridation or something that has done this.
It's got to be something.
It's not rational.
I think it's a lack of drugs probably is the problem.
Maybe. That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous where Charlie Rose is saying, yeah, but you know, Assad, he's killing his own people. He's at war against his own people and they're just trying to defend themselves from him. And Putin says, well, but you know, as you understand, 60% of the country is in the hands of these groups, the Al-Nusra Front and ISIS, and your government labels them as terrorist groups. The United Nations labels them as terrorist groups. They are terrorist groups. So, Charlie, what do you mean he's at war against his own people? He's defending his people from terrorist groups. And Charlie Rose is like, well, let me ask you something entirely different then.
Right. Yeah, what's that aftershave you're using?
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that President Obama likes you or what?
Incredible.
Yeah, amazing. And you know, yeah, Charlie Rose is the perfect thermometer for Washington, D.C. and the way they think about this, because it is the perfect double think, just like in 1984, where Charlie Rose does know this. Putin called him out. You know Charlie Rose, who the enemies are here. But then, you know, he just calls him out for having this separate part of his brain where he pretends that Assad is fighting only against civilians and not fighting against these groups that are trying to topple him. You know, and it's that perfect thing where you know that you know it's not true, but you go ahead and just stick with it anyway.
Yeah, that's straight right. I mean, the bottom line assumption on all this is the stuff that's come out of the White House is true, of course, and none of it is true. I mean, you know, this is a White House that dissimulates on virtually everything. And then we have that smooth-talking president of the United States who kind of gets up there and he's kind of a relaxing figure and he talks to you and that kind of thing. He's lying about everything he says.
Yeah. He really does seem like he's not very bothered by anything. He exudes that trust me kind of confidence that I guess will, just like when Jeb or Trump or whoever comes, will work on the other half of the people, and works on half, and then they switch. But
yeah, but you know, Trump. Did you see Trump's statement this morning ISIS?
Well, the one where he says that, you know, the rest of these Republicans want to have a third world war with Russia, and I say let Russia kill ISIS.
Yeah, he said, I'm willing to work with Russia and with Iran, which is
against working with them.
But I mean, the point is, you know, the fact is that he's recognizing that these are the players that are important to at least have some kind of relationship with if you're serious about doing any of these things. And of course, the White House has a resistance against this. It doesn't see that what everybody else sees, that it's not a simple black and white type equation that's going on there. It's much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, that's the perfect point to pick up and start talking about your article here, The Government We Deserve, at UNS.com, about the future of what's going to happen here in Syria. And it seems to me, I read a thing, I don't know if you saw this on Michael Scheuer's website, called One Last Chance. He says, to quote our enemies, God is great. And here he's given us such an out by getting the Russians involved in Syria. It's the perfect time for the Americans to simply knock it off. Forget a line with them. Just get the hell out of the way and let them make it their own problem and not ours.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly true. You know, the whole concept in the beginning that we were going to destroy these terrorist groups. I mean, we've been destroying Al Qaeda since 2001, and they're still around. It doesn't make any sense. And you're right. If the Russians can stabilize the situation for the Syrian government, God bless everybody involved. And you know,
as long as they provide cover for our exit, that's good enough for me.
That's right. If they lose, it doesn't make any difference. None of this makes any difference. The only tiny threat against the United States that emerges from this whole pot of things different things, is that ISIS, if it ever had the resources and everything, might try to stage some kind of terrorist attack in the United States. They might, but there's no evidence for that. And the fact is that, you know, none of this is a threat to the United States. Why we're involved in there is something that historians will never quite understand.
Well, and of course, if they do wage an attack here, it's either one, just simple revenge, or two, more likely trying to bait us back into invading again, which is,
yeah.
In fact, mm-hmm. I mean, really, this is, well, we're over the break now. I want to pick this up on the other side of the break here, because I want people to hear this, the live audience to hear this too, about continuing to prove bin Laden's strategy right from this side. But hang tight right there, Phil.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And yeah, no, seriously, 10 years later. It's 10 years later. It was 2005. Phil Giraldi reported in the American Conservative magazine that Cheney was floating a plan and was working with the Air Force on it, that if there was a major terrorist attack in the United States, they were going to find a way to blame it on Iran and then maybe even nuke them. Launch a full-scale aggressive war against them. That was the first time I interviewed Phil Giraldi, and I bet you could go back and find at scotthorton.org in the archives there. That very first interview, I asked Phil, so what do we do about the actual terrorism problem, never mind the fake one? And he said, ramp this whole thing down. That was the quote I remember. Ramp it down. Just knock it off. Quit making new enemies, and the old ones will fade away anyway. And now here we are, a decade later, Phil, having the exact same conversation, only now, hey, at least we got the Russians to take our place in the exact same fight, so that maybe is an easy excuse to go ahead and call it quits. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Putin is giving Obama a way out. Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, so now before the break, you were saying now that the only threat we face here is, you know, a possible terrorist attack by the Islamic State, or I guess maybe Al-Qaeda. And then I was saying, and although still, I think your point being that's nothing like an existential threat to the United States, or and it's obviously, you know, likely to fade away faster the faster we quit intervening over there. But then also I wanted to point out that the doctrinal fight, never mind the religious part of it, but the doctrinal fight in strategy between Zawahiri and the Islamic State guys is that Zawahiri and bin Laden always said, you got to keep fighting the Americans until they're all the way bankrupt and leave the Middle East entirely, because if you try to create a caliphate now, the Americans will come and bomb the hell out of it, and they'll support all the local dictators in crushing it and that kind of thing. So it sounds like actually, in a way, the Americans are still working on bin Laden's script, or off of bin Laden's script, and trying to prove him right, that we're going to, you know, at some points, at least anyway, like we're working with the Iranians in Shia Iraq against the Islamic State. We're working on proving them right and proving that they have to attack the United States in order to draw us back over there until the dollar finally really breaks, until the empire really breaks and has to go home. And obviously these guys are in it for the long haul, whether this guy's the caliph or the next guy or the next guy. And so, you know, it just seemed like, if that is the terrorist threat, we got to recognize why. They're trying to get us to do the same stupid thing they already got us to do one time, which was fall for it, like the big dumb bull headed for the red cape, you know?
Well, I mean, even the Pentagon recognizes the fact that that we're a recruiting poster for the terrorist groups, and that it's because we're over there that they're basically picking on us in a sense as their primary target. But what you're saying absolutely makes sense. I mean, if you were an Afghan civilian or an Iraqi or a Syrian or a Lebanese, and you're having your house bombed by the United States of America, is that exactly are those exactly moves that are going to turn you friendly? I mean, that's why these policies are so incredible. They're incomprehensible. They don't make any sense. It's not like the bombing campaign is going to destroy ISIS or anything at all, except a whole lot of Syrian houses and kill people. A lot of them are civilians. It's just a question of we don't quite figure out what comes next. See, when Obama says we got to get rid of Assad, well, okay, if you want to get rid of Assad, Mr. Obama, what comes next? And they can't seem to come up with an answer to any of this stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then they just still keep going. And the more cynical way to look at it is, you know, like David Wormser said, we want to expedite the chaotic collapse. We don't want it. And he was referring to Syria there. That they know that what comes next is the Muslim Brotherhood, if you're lucky, and probably a lot worse than that. And that's exactly what they've got. But, hey, good, because that means that Assad, I don't know, can devote fewer resources to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon or something. So it's all worth it.
Yeah, if to them it all fits together. I mean, if you go back to the Clean Break document of 1996, the idea basically is to break all the Arab states surrounding Israel into their constituent bits. And that means tribes in some cases. It means along religious lines in some other cases, and some other ethnic lines. And that's the policy. So if you have these fragmented Arab states surrounding Israel, they're not a threat to Israel. And that's the thinking. But of course, it's stupid too, because these places then become a breeding grounds for stuff that potentially is even worse. And, you know, how do you figure this stuff out? Obviously, with all these smart guys sitting in Washington on the National Security Council, why is it that they can't figure this out? You and I could figure it out.
Yeah, it's simple. Anybody listening to the show, you know, Chalmers Johnson used to say, anybody who reads antiwar.com or listens to this show on a regular basis understands this stuff way better than the people who are reading the CIA morning early bird newspaper that they give to the president and all the highest staff that they're looking at it, as Robert Gates says, through a soda straw. And you know, I mean, hell, anybody just reading the news in 2002 and 2003, anybody outside the government, out here in the country reading the news, knew better than to support that war. There are a lot of people in Washington, D.C. who everybody they knew supported it. They had such a tight consensus. They couldn't get their head around why 150 million Americans said that they opposed it. It was like half the country was all guilty of treason because we're all so pro-terrorist and pro-Saddam for knowing better than to do this. But that's what the polls said, you know, before the war actually started. It was 50-50 split against it. That's 150 million Americans saying, I don't know, seems like Saddam is the guy in the beret and Osama's the guy in the robe. And isn't that different, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was at CIA headquarters in 2002. And I knew a lot of the analysts that were working on this issue from the Counterterrorism Center. I used to go and talk to them, and they would say, you know, this stuff just doesn't fit. It's just not right, and so on and so forth. But the opinion of these guys, which was the really working-level guys, just never seemed to make it out up to the upper floors of the building. And that's characteristic of the government. It's like you're talking about the early morning report that the president sees. It's that report is tailored to what the president wants to see. And so they always throw in some things that are kind of controversial, but at the same time, it's essentially a ratification of the things that he already believes to be true. And the whole government works that way.
Yeah. I don't know if it's true, but I believe in it. In the Oliver Stone movie, when Brent Scowcroft writes, "Don't attack Saddam," in the Wall Street Journal, and George W. Bush throws a big hissy fit about it and doesn't want to hear anything more. I don't want to hear any more from Brent Scowcroft, which everybody knows is his father's best friend, is speaking for his father on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal saying, son, don't listen to these guys. Don't do it. And W just gets mad and doubles down, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, I think that probably is true. And the fact is, I mean, these people are essentially, they're locked into their own bubble. And the bubble doesn't really allow them to think outside it. And you see it again and again. I mean, this whole Syria situation, if we trace it back to when this started, I mean, this really started, what, about 2003 with the Syrian Accountability Act and a whole lot of pressure from Congress. But it's all the same players cranking this thing up and doing it for reasons best known to themselves, but essentially not thinking in terms of what are the consequences of what they're doing. They never do that.
Yeah. All right. Now, so I want to talk about this other important point that you bring up. Well, there's a couple more. I don't know if we have time for both of them, but kind of you can combine them, I guess, about the rules of engagement where journalists can be considered unlawful enemy combatants, which is on the same level of Al-Qaeda, right? No Geneva protections from you, that kind of thing. And then the other one is about this law professor at West Point. And this is what Todd Pierce, the judge advocate general defense attorney at Guantanamo Bay, is always writing about, is the stab in the back theory. It's common in Nazi Germany and it's common in post-Vietnam America, where the military convinces themselves that Americans and media people who oppose their stupid, evil wars, they're the reasons that the wars become failures. And it's that stab in the back and that, you know, as Andrew Sullivan said, the opposition to the war, they're a fifth column inside the United States. Well, nobody really cares that much when Andrew Sullivan says it, but when generals start saying it, that means, you know, that NDAA starts becoming less theoretical and more realistic. When, you know, that portion where they talk about putting us in military camps here. And so then you get into this story of this West Point professor, William Bradford. Can you explain the context of that?
Yeah, well, Bradford basically is as you say, or was, a West Point professor of law. And he has been advocating for a number of years that there is this fifth column of lawyers and others in the United States who are sympathetic to Islamic terrorism. And he defines that basically as anybody who talks to people who are even on the fringes of these groups or has anything to do with them. And he advocates, of course, charging them with treason. And, of course, the penalty for treason in the Constitution is death. And the other thing he advocates is basically declaring war on Islam and bombing the Islamic holy sites, which he admits would kill many, many tens of thousands of people, until the Muslims basically give up. He says he wants them to give up jihad. And anyway, so this guy was on the faculty of West Point, and he recently was forced to resign, not because of what he was saying, but because he had faked his resume. He faked the military decoration they didn't have, and he faked his academic credentials. And West Point, first of all, didn't check this stuff out. And secondly, the other stuff apparently was acceptable. So that's the Bradford story. The other story you're talking about is how the Army has recently come out with a rules of engagement manual. And within the manual, it defines journalists as potential terrorists and is alerting the troops to the fact that a guy can be a journalist, but in fact his sympathies might be with the terrorists. So in other words, it's turning these people, journalists, into potential targets of the U.S. military when the U.S. military is running an operation somewhere. I mean, this kind of stuff is, if you wrote it in a comic book, nobody would believe it.
Yeah, boy, it's out of control. I guess, you know, it's just, again, we're so far into this now. We're that far down the slippery slope where, you know, people can convince themselves these things. I mean, you know, I'd like to think that all of these guys, you know, in a Bill Clintonian way are saying, of course they hate us for bombing them and all that, you know? But it sounds like more and more, you know, I don't know, anybody with, I don't care how many stars of a general, any general who really believes the war is with the Muslims, that they're going to have to, what? We're going to nuke them until they all just lay down on their belly and say, yes, master, we'll never question a white North American again or something like that? Is the goal? We're going to keep nuking them until they surrender to that degree? I mean, that is, I mean, it's not just evil and horrible and imperial and whatever, but it's completely stupid. I mean, what is this? How is it that that's the discussion going on at that level of power?
Well, because for all of these guys in Washington, it's an abstraction. See, these guys are essentially at the top of the food chain. They really don't get their hands dirty. They, when I wrote a piece last week about torture and everything. It's the guys who don't get their hands dirty that find it easy to say, oh, yeah, let's do this. And they could probably talk to any Sergeant E5 in the United States Army who's actually been in these pacification schemes in various countries and stuff like that, who will tell them, you know, this stuff is insane. But, of course, nobody's listening to that guy. And it's the same thing with, you know, when you get up into the civilian ranks, the people who basically, they have groupthink. They talk to each other, and there are certain things that are acceptable for them to say and certain things that are not acceptable. And not acceptable is to question existing policies. And unfortunately, the policies become crazier and crazier.
Yeah, well, but then when they get to... you know, self-justification, like a dirty snowball rolling downhill kind of thing, too, where, I mean, at least this guy, I think they wrote a thing saying, we're embarrassed that we ran this article, we shouldn't have ran it, or something like that. Yeah, where, so he's maybe a little bit out in front of the rest of these guys. But actually, again, they made this legal. Obama signed it. The Congress passed it in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that actually, Phil, they could say, we're sick and tired of UNS.com, and Phil, you're going to military, to a camp, right? We're not gonna charge you. We're just gonna hold you until you're done talking or writing or whatever your problem is, or until we feel like letting you go. That's the law right now.
Sure. That's like Major Todd Pierce has said. I mean, he said, you know, the difference between the road we're going down and the point we're at and what happened in Nazi Germany is not that great. And anybody that argues that it can't happen here, I think is completely wrong. It can happen here. It is happening here. And people have to wake up to this fact.
Yep. And it certainly happened before. All right. Well, listen, I already kept you over time. Thanks very much, Phil. Have a great rest of your afternoon. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all, that's Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest, the American Conservative Magazine, and UNS.com, UNZ, UNS.com. Right back after this. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. That's where I hang out. Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. Yeah, man. So Yemen first, then Libya, then Afghanistan, then Israel, or something. Saudi warplanes kill 131 in attack on wedding party. And when Jason Ditz writes Saudi warplanes, he means USA. Because, of course, they got all their weapons from us. And because, of course, America's coordinating the whole war for them. Because their Air Force is worthless. They can fly their plane to the GPS target and drop their JDAM and turn around and fly home. Yeah, sure. But the rest of it is the Americans. Saudi warplanes kill 131 in attack on a wedding. 131. Get it? Entire families wiped out. Generations of families erased from the face of the earth. Adding to the enormous death toll of the Saudi war against Yemen. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Adding to the enormous death toll of the Saudi war against Yemen, Saudi warplanes today attacked a wedding party near the port city of Mocha, killing the groom and a huge number of civilians, with at least 131 confirmed dead,
in the latest reports from medical officials. The attack does not appear to have been accidental, quote-unquote, like so many other Saudi airstrikes, but rather targeted a Shiite wedding because the groom was seen as being, quote, affiliated with the Houthis. Actually, what this affiliation was is unclear. The timing couldn't have been worse for the Saudi government, as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was to address the UN Assembly just hours later and slam the Saudi war against Yemen, demanding an immediate end to the airstrikes. All sides are showing disregard for human life, but most of the casualties are being caused by airstrikes, Ban noted. Some 5,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in the Saudi war, with virtually all of the major incidents the result of airstrikes. Amazing. Well, anyway, I guess they don't really have any Ban Ki-moon giving a speech. Is all the pressure on them to knock it off? They've got none, right? As long as Obama and you and me and our money have their back, they're going to continue on. They're on a mission, man. They're at least going to drive the Houthis out of Sana'a or die trying. I don't know if they'll ever really be able to put Hadi back in power. Jason Ditz explained that the state of Yemen may not survive. We may end up with Houthi Stan in the north and the socialist south breaking off from the east and God knows what. Saudi warplanes kill 131. And America's still doing drone strikes on Al-Qaeda at the same time that we're flying as their air force against the Houthis. And they have made major gains there. I don't know how many of them they've held, but at certain points they've seized armories, airports, seaports. At one point a military base, I believe. So here America takes Al-Qaeda in Yemen, bombs the hell out of it with a drone war for years on end, and ends up creating a huge group out of what started as just a few men. It was nothing but make them more and more and more powerful as he drives more and more people into their group by bombing them. At the same time, all the money that he's giving to Saleh, the dictator, is going to fighting the Houthis, not Al-Qaeda. And in fighting the Houthis, all he does is fail and make them more and more powerful. Four different campaigns against them, and the Houthis get more and more powerful. Then when the Arab Spring comes, it's the consensus on virtually every faction in the country. They want Saleh gone, the American-backed sock puppet dictator. So Hillary eases him out and replaces him with his vice president, Hadi, or his chief of staff, or whatever. I guess he's his vice president. And, you know, does what they wanted to do in Egypt, which was go ahead and, you know, replace him with the next mustache in line, as Greg Palast would say, rather than, you know, allow there to be a real revolution. But then nobody really supported Hadi. He won in an election where he was the only guy on the ballot. Hillary hailed it as democracy, you know, on the march in full effect, actually, not just getting there. And so he had virtually no support, and the Houthis by that point had grown up strong enough to overthrow him and drive him out of power. He fled from Sana'a to Aden on the Gulf Coast there, and then they forced him out of there too, into exile. At that point, this is about 5 months ago now, at that point the Saudis started a full-scale bombing campaign. They brought in the entire GCC except for Oman, have been in on it. They have ground forces from the UAE there now. And I think Algeria, Morocco, and Egypt, or I don't know about Egypt, Algeria and Morocco have chipped in somewhat too from North Africa in the bombing campaign. You have a full-scale blockade starving the civilian population of Yemen. And it was the poorest country in the Middle East. Can you imagine that? There's even such a thing as that, right? The poorest one, Yemen. And they import about 80% of their food. They're entirely dependent on imported food, and their markets are completely destroyed, and gasoline prices are through the roof, or it's completely unavailable at any price. All their market systems are breaking down. People are starving to death. And America, at this point, as we speak right now, Americans are coordinating Saudi flights to go drop bombs on the Houthis, basically serving as air cover for al-Qaeda fighters on the ground, at the same time that that the CIA and or the Air Force are flying drones and attacking al-Qaeda targets at the very same time. It's like the Iraq War, where we back Iran against the Islamic State and the jihadists in Iraq on the Shiite side there, but we, the U.S. government, the evil empire, supports the Mujahideen on the Sunni jihadist side against the Iranian-backed factions in Syria on the western border of the Islamic State. But geez, in Yemen, both at the very same time, in such a small country, it just seems extra ironical to me, I guess. I don't know. And horrible. And all Obama has to do to end this war is just to end it. That's it. All he has to do is tell his chief of staff, or just pick up the phone himself, call the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, notify the Air Force, the Navy, Special Forces, etc. The Yemen war is over now. We're done. And that's it. The Saudis can't even wage this war without us. It'd be over. Boy, that leading from behind sure is useful for something, isn't it? Look at me. I'm leading from behind. I'm having a war, and nobody's even mad at me for it. Because TV won't even tell you who's who. And all you have to do is stop and think about it. You don't even have to read the Wall Street Journal. All you have to do is think for a minute. Is the Saudi Air Force capable of doing this by themselves? Answer, no. Question, well, who's running it for them then? Answer, there's only one possible answer. America. Oh, also it's in the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. So, there you are. All right. Yeah, Yemen, man. Good, music's playing. When we get back, Afghanistan, Libya, oh yeah, Libya next, then Afghanistan, and then Israel-Palestine, police state stuff too. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really gonna have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm an anti-government extremist. Focusing mostly on foreign policy stuff, you know. The worst stuff. So, I don't know, man. It's stupid, but the Benghazi probe is now the longest in congressional history. Is that really true? What about the House on Un-American Activities Committee's investigations into the Reds? And stuff like that. ABC News says, 72 weeks straight, surpassing the record previously held by the Watergate Committee in the 70s. And what's funny about that is just how stupid. Just how badly they missed the point. And wait, don't get me wrong, because I'm not taking the Democrat point of view that, hey, there's no scandal there. I'm saying the people who say there's a scandal are right, but they're missing it. the scandal is not just that there wasn't good enough security for the ambassador and his men at this outpost in Benghazi, Libya, September 11th, 2012, when they were killed by a band of marauding somebodies. And the scandal is not just that this isn't the movies, and the CIA and the military are not ready to go at a moment's notice, G.I. Joe, to go in and save each other. They do things like wait around to find out what it looks like after sunup. Once we're done gassing up the truck and taking their sweet ass, stupid ass time. That is scandalous. They suck. But that's not the scandal. The scandal, of course, is in the question you ought to ask in the first place. Where the hell is Benghazi and what was our ambassador doing there? I thought the capital of Libya was Tripoli. Well, the thing of it was, there was a massive covert operation to funnel Mujahideen and guns to Syria. Because Obama and Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus and Leon Panetta and all of these guys, they took the side of America's enemies, Al-Qaeda. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, when they're in Al-Qaeda, they're called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Right now, at this moment, they're aligned with the Islamic State. In 2011, they were the veterans of Iraq War II who had come home. Right? Just like bin Laden and other people in the Azam group were the veterans of the Afghan War who had come home after the Afghan War in the 1980s to cause problems in the 1990s. Well, here are the veterans of Bush's Gladiator Academy. Remember, America fought to turn all of eastern Iraq from Baghdad down to Kuwait over to the Shiite militias, and then, in effect, turned all of western and northwestern Iraq into bin Ladenstan. And that was the Sunni-based insurgency and untold thousands and thousands of jihadists who went there and fought under Zarqawi and associated with him. And it was from eastern Libya where the most Libyans had gone to fight in that war. Then when they came home and the Arab Spring started in Tunisia and Egypt and the uprisings began in Libya, they were the guys that America backed in their war against Gaddafi. And this was all told at the time. You know, I mentioned Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, on the show earlier. You know, obviously, Phil and I talked about this at the time. You go back and listen to interviews of Giraldi about it. I don't know if I interviewed Scheuer about it at the time or not, but I absolutely remember Scheuer doing an interview on CNN where he's saying, look, these guys, and they're treating him with respect because he's a former CIA guy, so they worship him and stuff, only he's like, you know, being his most politically incorrect self and telling them the blatant truth, and these two ladies don't know what to do with him. And he's saying, look, these guys are the Mujahideen. In any other situation, we would say these guys are the Mujahideen. They're our enemies. And here we are, we're fighting for them. And the ladies say, yeah, but the guys that we're fighting for, they're not saying, hi, we're Al-Qaeda. And Short says, yeah, but that's because the guys who are really our worst enemies, they're not actually, you know, coming up to us and dealing with the CIA, but that doesn't mean they're not there. That just means that they're the guys that you're helping win anyway. And they're like, nuh-uh, because I don't think that could be true because that doesn't make a lot of sense to do, does it? So you must be wrong. And then Shore gets mad at him. You're just carrying water for Barack Obama, that's all. And they're like, what, man? It's funny. I like Shore. He does not tolerate ridiculousness. He does not suffer fools, CNN ones. Anyway, they were so warned. Patrick Coburn was on the show. Pepe Escobar was on the show. A million other. Everybody who knew anything about this was on the show. Probably Flint Leverett and Gareth Porter and everybody. Who's America fighting for in Libya in 2011? Bin Laden's men. Zarqawi's men. That's who they are. And you know who else said that? Gaddafi. And he was right. And by the way, I beg you to go and read this four-part series by Kelly Riddell and, I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, Jeffrey something, I think. Anyway, it's at the Washington Times, and they've done a lot of coverage of the Benghazi scandal, you know, the small one. But also, they did a five-part series a four-part series about the way that Hillary buffaloed us into war, how the CIA, the military, General Hamm, the head of African Command, and the Pentagon, and Dennis Kucinich, I already said that, and Dennis Kucinich, they were all negotiating with the Libyan government, with Gaddafi's sons, and they were going to retire his ass, and then his son, he had one son who actually really did believe in all this free markets and democracy stuff, and really wanted to bring Libya into the future and integrate it with Europe and American power and join the WTO and whatever, whatever. He really was like that. And in this article, they really go into that and how they had such a good option in getting rid of Muammar Gaddafi, promoting his son, and then, you know, whatever, demanding whatever reforms, like in their talking points, when what they really want is oil concessions. And he clearly was willing to deal with that, you know, deal with them on that. And they absolutely could have avoided war 100 ways. And Hillary refused. Hillary stomped on the Pentagon, the CIA, and Dennis Kucinich and all their efforts to negotiate a peaceful resolution to the thing. And then Obama gives a speech at the UN yesterday, and he says mistakes were made in Libya. Not, is he saying, well, gee, maybe after George Bush convinced Gaddafi to give up all of his centrifuges, and they were still all in boxes and whatever, but his potential nuclear program in exchange for, you know, basically a handshake security guarantee here and welcoming him back into the fold. Maybe it doesn't make sense to betray a country that would deal with us like that and stab him in the back and kill him and have him lynched, have him raped with a knife and shot in the back of the head on the side of the road less than 10 years later. Nope. The answer is we should have stayed. We should have done more purple-fingered elections and build them a new army and create a democracy. That's his regret. We don't have an Iraq war-sized occupation going on in Libya right now. Hey, it's not too late, Barack. Dear leader. Muammar. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. All right, Afghanistan a minute. I want to talk a little bit of politics. I just think it's funny that people think that Hillary Clinton is electable at all. And, yeah, I'm not saying I think Biden is or anybody else necessarily either, but she is just so horrible. And the insistence that she's not. On the part of the liberals and the Democrats who support her and the you know, the party leaders and all that. It's hilarious to me, you know. It's an experiment in cognitive dissonance. Like, well, I know I hate her guts and Susie and Linda, we all hate her, but yeah, we love Hillary. Come on, because we all love her, right? And I'm thinking she's a jobber for Jeb. Unless Trump succeeds in being a jobber for her. Because if it's Trump, she's going to win. But if it's Jeb, Jeb's going to win. And it is possible, however unlikely. It is possible, however unlikely, that Trump could get the nomination. And now here's the thing about it, and I'm not the world's master expert about electoral political history and this and that, but I'm trying to think, and I really don't think that the outsider
further left or further right candidate has won the nomination for president any time that I can think of in the 20th century, even other than Goldwater in 1964. You know, Nelson Rockefeller was Jeb, and Goldwater was Trump, so to speak, kind of, sort of. And what usually happens in that situation is the party leaders say, look, the guy that's further to the right, or if it was mirror image in the other party, they would say the guy that's further to the left has a much worse shot, a lesser chance in the general election. When you got to be the moderate, you got to be the conservative Democrat or the liberal Republican centrist to get all the swing voters to win. And so it just doesn't make tactical sense to elect the true believer when you can go with the wishy-washy. And yet what happened in 64 was Nelson Rockefeller dumped his wife and married some floozy 2 weeks later, and it was the biggest scandal in the whole world. And all the Catholics and all the Protestants said, just forget this guy. And then Goldwater went in there and took South Carolina, New Hampshire, and Iowa, and it was on. But then what happened? He got his clock completely cleaned by Lyndon Johnson, who was just as bad on Vietnam as Goldwater was. Although, I don't know. I guess Rothbard took him seriously, that he really would consider using nuclear weapons, or at least Johnson didn't get that freaking bad. But he did kill more than a million people, so. Maybe more than a couple of million. But anyway, the way this always works out, remember Dean in 2004? Oh, Howard Dean, all the liberals love him. All the Democrat voters love him. He's the guy. But no, he's not. All the party guys said John Kerry is whiter and richer and more Yale and is a longtime senator, not a former governor. And if anybody can beat George Bush, it's his clone in the Democratic Party. His fellow bonesman. And they were right, only Kerry just ran the worst campaign in the whole world. It was because that guy Bob Schrum, he did the same thing to Al Gore. That guy Bob Schrum is such an idiot. He has all these Democrats run as Republicans and then lose. He ought to be running the Libertarian Party. Yeah, guys, your strategy of running as Republicans who couldn't possibly win is really working out well. Keep doing that. You know? But he certainly could have won. If John Kerry just personally had been reading antiwar.com every day in 2004 and then just giving his speeches off the cuff, he would have cleaned George Bush's clock. But anyway, that's how it works. So it doesn't make sense for the Republican Party establishment to allow Trump to be the nominee, no matter what the people of the party want. And Jeb is just lousy. I mean, really, I gotta admit, the fact that, I mean, I'm not saying I favor him or anything. I guess sometimes I truncate the antecedents. Here's how you know Jeb is the guy. Because the bankers, the arms dealers, the oil men, the Israelis, and the agribusiness, and whoever, I guess the retired, he's got them all locked up. All the big pressure groups got him locked up. I'm sure the gun lobby doesn't have any real problem with him anyway. Even if they're not, you know, he's not their guy. But when it comes to the bankers and the insurance companies and the military industrial complex and all that, they have confidence in Brand Bush. So he is just the default to inherit the power here. That's all. But I think W is a much better campaigner. And I think when it comes to who would you rather have a mug of beer with test, that Hillary might even win over Jeb. He's terrible. I mean, at least his name is Jeb, so he sounds kind of like a redneck. But really, Jed would be the better name for that, to be a people person. But anyway, he just seems like he hadn't met a real human being in 20 years or maybe ever in his life, you know? If you didn't go to the same prep school as him, he's never met you. He didn't know. He has no idea what actual humans are like. Whereas Junior, I think, you know, he spent time around working class people enough where he had kind of that understanding of, he could mimic a human, you know? Jeb has a bit more trouble. But anyway, it's still interesting to watch the thing. And it is interesting that you know, Trump, I'm not sure who all owns his narratives, but like we were talking about with Giraldi earlier, for him to say, hell, let Russia fight ISIS, what do I care? Boy, he is off script, man. That is not what you're supposed to say. What you're supposed to say is, oh, whatever Benjamin Netanyahu's emotions dictate, that's what I think. And, oh, Bashar al-Assad, he's bad because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants. That is the Republican line. And Trump apparently has never even heard of it or doesn't care. And he's horrible on everything, by the way. I'm not saying he's not horrible. In fact, there's even a YouTube of him saying, congratulations on your re-election, the great leader, King of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu or whatever, right? Yeah, you know. I'm not apologizing for the guy or anything. I'm just saying, it's interesting the way he seems just a little bit divorced from all the right people shouting in his ear what he's supposed to be saying. Trump, I guess, has yet to go and bow down before the John Hay Institute to be told what to say and think by Elliot Abrams and Paul Wolfowitz. But maybe it's only a matter of time. But boy, and what he says about Russia, too. You know, they ask him about Russia. He's like, look, you think, what, we can just be enemies with everybody? We got to be friends with somebody. He turned it into an attack on Obama. Obama's got us enemies with everybody. We got to be friends with somebody. And look, Russia, what, they're not the Soviets. We can work with them. I'll meet with Putin. We'll talk. We'll negotiate. And it'll be fine. We'll find mutual interests and work together. You're not supposed to say that. That's bad. It's interesting, his cover, right? I'm the most militarist guy up here. But then on the specifics, no, he's not. He's not anything like, that was what, it was Gene Healy, right? Remember I interviewed Gene Healy on the show. And Gene Healy's like, man, you're not even close to the most militaristic person on the stage up there. Fiorina and Rubio and Jeb and even Rand, Trump beat on Russia, on the Islamic State. Well, I don't know. Nah, they're equally as horrible on the Islamic State, I guess. Equally horrible on Iran. Anyway. I just like watching politics. It's kind of funny. And Jeb is just horrible. I used to say, come on, it's definitely going to be Jeb unless, you know, he accidentally screws up and says the N-word in front of an open microphone or something like that. But then I had to concede that, you know what, maybe Trump is that wild card that amounts to, you know, Jeb's big blunder. And he's way down in the polls in New Hampshire and in Iowa. He's not, I'm sorry, I hadn't looked at Real Clear Politics today, but he's been way, way down in the polls there. So I guess it remains to be seen what's going to happen. But he's got more money than anybody, so he can outlast when everybody else drops out. So it's still, I think it'll come down to Trump versus Jeb in the end. Anyway. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Okay, guys, wrapping up the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show on Liberty Radio Network. Subscribe to the archives, full shows, or just the interviews at scotthorton.org. Stitcher or iTunes or your RSS catcher of whatever kind. Tomorrow, James Bamford is going to be on about his new article, Did a Rogue NSA Operation Cause the Death of a Greek Telecom Employee? Oh. And then Greg Grandin is going to be on about his article that he wrote for Tom Dispatch about Henry Kissinger. You thought that the history of all the people he got killed had been written, but no. comes Greg Grandin with more people that Kissinger killed. So many people. Anyway, so that's coming up on the show on Thursday. All right. Hey, did you hear that Snowden's on Twitter? He won't follow you back, though. So far, he's only following the NSA. But, yeah, so there he is. He's just at Snowden. If you want to follow him on Twitter, that might become interesting at some point. And then, I was going to say here, I talked about that and that and that. Oh, I'm going to try to get Anand Gopal on, guys, to talk about Afghanistan for us here. He knows the most about it, I think, of everybody that I know. Here's what I know. I mentioned this yesterday. Taliban captures major North Afghan city of Kunduz. Interior Ministry. Defenses in city collapsed in face of latest offensive. Oh, remind me to talk about Bangladesh in a second, guys, because there was an ISIS bombing in Bangladesh. I'm going to forget that. Interior Minister defended. During the spring offensive, the Taliban set its sights on northern parts of Afghanistan, particularly centering on the Kunduz province. The fighting continued through the spring and summer, with Taliban forces seizing several districts. Today, they captured the city of Kunduz itself. The Afghan Interior Ministry confirmed that defenses in the city had collapsed in the face of the latest offensive, and while they're talking up a counteroffensive to try to retake the city, the Taliban have wasted no time in capturing all the significant buildings in the city and are moving on the airport. They also captured the city's main prison, releasing hundreds of Taliban forces that had been held there, who will now be reinforcing the defense of the city. This is the second major prison break the Taliban has done in the last month. The loss of Kunduz is a huge blow to the Afghan government because it had never really been under the control of the Taliban, even when the Taliban were in power. Kunduz was the center of the Northern Alliance rebellion against the Taliban, which eventually took over the key government positions during the U.S. occupation and holds them to this day. Wow, so major setbacks for David Petraeus's big surge. You noticed after the Iraq War, the 2007 and 8, they went, oh, the surge is working, the surge is working, the surge worked, the surge worked. And then you're supposed to just memorize that and believe it, even though it never was true. Look. But in Afghanistan, they didn't even try it, did they? They didn't even really try. I think they tried the surge is working a little bit for a little while, but then they kind of just shut up and said, you know what? Republicans hate Obama, so they don't want to give him credit for killing Afghans, so they don't want to pay any attention to it. And the liberal Democrats, why, they just love Obama, and so they don't want to have to deal with the cognitive dissonance of paying attention to how many people he's slaughtering in Afghanistan, and so they just don't want to pay any attention either, so let's just kind of let it go away. Maybe at some point we can sort of pseudo kind of, oh, how about that, pseudo kind of? Declare victory at some point. I don't know. Obama signed a deal to stay till 2024 in some numbers. But so that's about 10,000 Americans, I think. And another few thousand NATO guys plus mercs and spies. But it's not that much. And, one thing that I think could happen could be a Saigon embassy type of catastrophe here. Remember in 2009, the deal was that we're going to surge in there, give us an extra 60,000 guys, we're going to surge in there, or 90,000, and we're going to beat up on the Taliban so bad, not that Petraeus and McChrystal were even promising to defeat them, but just we're going to beat up on them so bad that then they'll be crying and nursing their bloody nose, and then they'll come to the table and agree to our terms, which will be leave the rest of Afghanistan alone forever, because we say so. And that is going to happen by 2011, by July of 2011. That is the hard deadline. And Obama went for it, and he said, all right, Petraeus, you say it's going to work, man. Go ahead. And so they prolonged the war by years and years. They killed tens of thousands of people. They raised up entire armies and police forces of child rapists. No, really. It's not just this recent New York Times story. Maybe that was the first you heard of it, possibly. I've noticed a lot of reaction to this. Like, people have never heard of this before. But I talked about this on the show. I tried to get the guy on the show. He wouldn't do my show because I don't know why. But the guy from Vice did the documentary, This Is What Victory Looks Like. Have you seen that? This Is What Victory Looks Like, about the war in Afghanistan. And it's interviews with these soldiers whose job it is to protect these child rapist, thug, evil, killer warlords.
Yep, my job is making sure that him and his men are safe.
Working for the Democrats. And that was a couple of years ago. And this is an ongoing thing this whole time. And that's all the surge was, to stand up these forces, and then they can't stand up to the Taliban. And put yourself in the position of the people of Afghanistan. I'm sure they don't want to be ruled by the Taliban again. But the Taliban are not corrupt, right? They're authoritarian, and they're mean as hell. But they don't extort you. They don't bribe you. They don't rape your wife. They don't kidnap your son. They got harsh punishments. They got a harsh system of law, and their oppression of women is absolute, but it's not arbitrary. And so you have at least, you know, huge parts of the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan who, you got to figure there's at least some support for these guys, or else who are they, right? They're the sons and fathers of that area who are doing this fighting. It's not like Obama and Prince Bandar, you know, bust them all in from Saudi Arabia. They are the locals. And Justin Raimondo had an article at antiwar.com the other day about this is how they got power in the first place. Is all the warlords and their nonstop fighting over Kabul and their, you know, just rampant shelling of each other and each other's factions, kidnappings and rapes and murder and corruption and extortion. And the Taliban came in and said, hey, man, there's only one God and his messenger, and we are here to do his will, which is to make you knock it off. And that was how they ruled the place. I'm not apologizing for them. I'm just saying that's the reality of the situation. They're authoritarian monsters. They don't believe in freedom at all. But they're not corrupt. And so you can see why they're on the march, because guess who's corrupt? Everybody America's been working with there for 14 years. Oh, can you believe that? That all the money has gone to all the worst people? Of course. And then, yeah, I guess I didn't realize, as Jason says, that Kunduz was never controlled by the Taliban in the first place. So that could be interpreted, right, to mean that, hey, if they can take Kunduz, then the rest of the country is basically up for grabs. You know, I said to Ann Jones on the show, the journalist Ann Jones, back 2 years ago or something, I said, you know, it seems like without much of an American presence there, the Taliban could just walk right back into Kabul. And she said, the Taliban's already in Kabul. They're in the government. Some of the ministers are Taliban. A great portion of the parliament are Taliban. They're already part of the government right now. But then I guess she said, oh yeah, but you know, I see what you mean. Take it over completely? Yeah. Although at this point, why bother? Everything's working out fine. Anyway, and you know what? I'm sure that the Taliban are plenty corrupt, but I guess a more accurate way to put it would be only on the highest level, right? Like if you live in a mafia town, you can sleep with your door unlocked as long as you're just a regular Joe and you don't have any business with them, because they have a real monopoly on crime. No freelance burglaries allowed, so real security provided, that kind of thing. And they don't pick on the average Joe in that way. That's how they got accepted back then. Anyway, gotta go.